Come on, Izzy. Run faster, you're going to miss the train. Come on. You're nearly there. You've got another 10 meters. I'll hold out my hand. You've got to jump. 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 Oh, God. That was close. How on earth? Why are you so late? How can you miss a steam train? How can you nearly miss a steam train? We're only doing 3 miles an hour.
Well, you said 10:30, so I said, well, you know, it would be 10:20.
I did not say 10:30. I did not say 10:30. I said 10:25 is the leaving time.
You said 10:30.
Definitely not. I think you drank too much in the pub last night. Anyway, look, okay, let's not argue. As the train lurches forward and builds up a head of steam, heralding the start of another literary excursion into the world of British poetry, it's all aboard for our second episode of Poetry Pod, Travel and Transport.
Hello and welcome to the Poetry Pod. My name is Izzy.
And I'm Orlando.
And we're two people who like poetry.
Love poetry.
Right. Who love poetry, and we want to share that love.
With you.
In our first season, we'll be looking at British culture through the lens of poetry. Welcome to the Poetry Pod. Season 1, Written Through the Bards.
Okay, Izzy, let's just go through this carriage here. Let's find a place to sit down. Here, this looks quite comfy, this little compartment here. Oh, gosh, that was exciting, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a bit too much for my liking.
Okay, welcome to our virtual train, a lyrical locomotive chuffing cheerfully along the literary tram lines of British history, stopping at Nostalgia Central, Poetry Parkway, and Jollification Junction. What do you think of my alliteration?
It's too much.
Too much?
Yeah, we spoke about this in the first episode.
I thought you liked it.
Yeah, but, you know, everything in moderation.
Everything in moderation. Okay, I'll make a note of it for next time.
Yeah, as in less, not more.
All right, message received and understood. But you have to admit, we have a meaty and miraculous show for you today.
Less, not more. Right. But, yeah, we certainly have. We'll be taking you on train lines through the Lake District. We'll be travelling to deserted islands and beautiful views.
Oh, that sounds so good.
But before things get too nice and harmonious,
Okay.
We've got a quiz coming up.
Okay.
And we'll see whether I can beat you this time.
All right, yeah. Well, I set the bar pretty high last time.
Did, yeah.
We'll see, yeah. And let's not forget our special guest today.
Yeah, we have a special guest today. We've got Rowan McCabe coming on.
That's fantastic.
He's from Newcastle, and he's the world's
only
door-to-door poet.
A door-to-door poet, so not a door-to-door salesman, but a door-to-door poet.
And, well, why don't we let him introduce himself?
I'm a door-to-door poet. And I know that sounds quite crazy, but this could be worse, though. I could be the Avon lady. In school, the taught us poetry's bust, ruled by toffs who've turned to dust on country manners, deathly shrouds, serious lords and fluffy clouds. I found it quite hard to relate. I grew up on a rough estate, walls thin as paper, used to trace the clouds an endless tone of grey. I'm here to make poetry exciting, like bungee jumping, but less frightening. And I'm standing here to find the subjects that flow through your mind. Tell us about your life. Okay, maybe not the whole of it. I'll stick it in a poem, or at least have a decent go at it. Maybe you heard a great story you'd love to hear in rhyme. Maybe your blood is boiling from a recent council fine. Maybe you dropped your smartphone and it fell down the toilet. I don't know. I can't decide for you because that would spoil it. So cheers for listening to these verses. I hope I got across my purpose. Don't slam the door. Don't be nervous. The door-to-door poet is at your service.
Very interesting. I really look forward to meeting him, actually.
Yeah, same.
It's a fascinating job he has. I haven't actually seen him. He's supposed to be on board the train, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
What does he look like?
Sort of brown hair, leather briefcase.
So he looks like a travelling salesman, basically.
Looks like a traveling salesman.
Well, I saw plenty of those, but I didn't see a young one with long, flowing a mane of black hair. Didn't see him get on board. I hope he's on board. But anyway, well, you wouldn't have seen him. You were late. But there we are. Let's not get into a fight about it.
Yeah, Well, you know, actually, before we get into a fight, let me make up for being late by throwing in a very quick poem for you.
I think that's a very good idea.
By Robert Louis Stevenson.
Who better? Who better?
Yeah. It's called From a Railway Carriage. And it goes like this. Faster than fairies, faster than witches, bridges and houses, hedges and ditches, and charging along like troops in a battle all through the meadows, the horses and cattle. All of the sights of the hill and the plain fly as thick as driving rain, and ever again in the wink of an eye, painted stations whistle by. Here is a child who clambers and scrambles all by himself and gathering brambles. Here is a tramp who stands and gazes, and there is the green for stringing the daisies. Here is a cart run away in the road, lumping along with man and load. And here is a mill, and there is a river, each a glimpse and gone forever.
That's exactly how I feel on our train, although we're not going fast enough. We're doing 20 miles an hour now. So things, I mean, not getting glimpses, I can actually see things very close up. That, you know, that really reminds me, do you know The Night Mail by W.H. Auden?
Yeah, very similar.
Very similar. But I think this was probably written, obviously, almost certainly written before. Mm-hmm. And do you know, The Night Mail, the precursor to The Night Mail, was a poem called The Night Mail North by Henry Cholmondeley Pennell.
Interesting name.
Very interesting name. Very British name. Mm. But yeah, I didn't know that. Mm.
Speaking of the British,
yes,
travelling, what's the obsession all about? Because the British love travelling, right?
I think it's, very historically, we travel a lot. In the UK, mm-hmm. we actually discovered a lot of places, at least we claim to have discovered them. They were there already, of course.
And other people had discovered them.
That's true, while they were living there, weren't they? But we claim to have discovered them. I guess it's to do with the fact that we're an island, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, island mentality, so everywhere is sort of a yearning to get away, get out.
I mean, look at the weather in Britain, right?
Yeah.
You'd want to get away from that.
That's a fair point. Yeah. Fair point. The food as well, perhaps. And British history, of course, the development of the British Empire, and of course, the Industrial Revolution, which began in the UK.
Right.
I tell you what.
Yeah.
All of this sort of chatting about British history, why don't I give a potted guide to the development of travel and transport in
Britain. Yeah, why not?
Shall I do that?
Yeah, so how long?
Well, I have actually compiled some notes. I mean, I was thinking of maybe 25 minutes lecture, perhaps.
Do you think you could shorten it a little to maybe...
A little? So 20 minutes?
2 minutes.
Two?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're a professional, right?
Well, I'd like to think I am, but what do I get in return? What are you going to give me as an incentive to do it in 2 minutes?
I'm going
to
be really proud of you.
Okay, that'll do the trick. Here we go. Britain and travel in 2 minutes. You're going to time it?
I'm going to time definitely. 2 minutes,
okay.
Right?
I'm
all right.
I'm ready. Okay.
Good. Ready, set, go.
The British obsession with travel began even as the horse and ploughshare were commonplace in the pastoral ambience of the 16th century. Explorations in the Elizabethan age were undertaken due to various reasons. Trade and commerce was, of course, high on the list. The discovery of new lands helped the monarchy to establish new business relations or even new colonies. Sir Francis Drake led the second expedition to sail around the world in a voyage lasting from 1577 to 1580, the first person to lead the voyage being Magellan. Sir Walter Raleigh became famous for the discovery of Guyana and establishing the Virginia colony of Roanoke Island in 1584. And Henry Hudson, an English explorer and navigator who lived from 1565 to 1611, explored parts of the Arctic Ocean and northeastern parts of North America. It must also be noted that several early British explorers were also partially responsible for beginning the slave trade. The advent of the Industrial Revolution, which began initially in Britain, heralded a new age of travel and transport. By the mid-18th century, Britain was the world's leading commercial nation, controlling a global trading empire with colonies in North America and the Caribbean, and of course, a lot achieved through the East India Company. British inventors fueled the rise of the steam locomotive. Trevithick, Murray and Stevenson were the pioneers with the Colebrookdale locomotive, built by Trevithick in 1802, as the first full-scale steam locomotive. In 1830, the Liverpool-Manchester Railway became the world's first intercity passenger railway, and the first to have scheduled services, terminal stations and services as we know them today. Steam trains got faster, the Mallard and the Flying Scotsman among them. Full nationalisation came by 1920. The Restoration and Victorian eras saw explorers such as Cook, Franklin, and Ross open up the Antarctic and Arctic to the cartographer, while Africa was discovered by explorers such as Livingston, Mary Kingsley, and Stanley. Nothing changed in the 20th century. The British obsession to go higher, further, and faster led to the exploration of the Himalaya by luminaries such as Shipton, Arabia and Oman by Lawrence and Thesiger, land speed records set by Donald Campbell and Richard Noble, the first Atlantic crossing in an aircraft by Alcock and Brown and Beryl Markham. The colder regions were further unlocked by remarkable expeditions of Shackleton and Scott, with thanks to Wikipedia.
That How did was I do? 2 minutes and 27 seconds.
2 minutes 27?
Yeah, so you're about as punctual as British Rail, aren't you?
Well, perhaps slightly more punctual, I would like to think. Have I earned your undying respect?
No, of course not.
Okay, I have to be a bit more punctual in future. Well, there we are. You know, our train seems to be slowing down.
Yeah.
Speaking of British Rail, that happens quite a lot.
Oh, God. I wonder what their excuse is this time.
Do you think it could be that age-old excuse, leaves on the line?
Probably, yeah.
Do you know the one, adverse weather conditions? Have you ever heard that one?
Yeah.
That's a real favourite.
Yeah.
It's a hidden gem of British Rail. Yeah. Adverse. You know, I was standing on Putney Station in London waiting for a train, and somebody came over the tannoy and said, "We are terribly sorry for the late arrival of the 1540 to London Waterloo. This is due to reverse weather conditions."
So what, it was the, you know, the rain being pushed back into the clouds?
Yeah, I don't know, but it made me laugh. Anyway, yeah, it's funny. I mean, okay, so obviously... the Brits generally were fans of exploration and fans of moving things forward. And Robert Louis Stevenson, obviously a great fan of the railway. But there were poets who were not a fan of all of this development.
Oh.
In fact, one who was living at this time, in the time of the Industrial Revolution, William Wordsworth, who I think we had on our show last time. And he was very much against the development of the... Kendal and Windermere Railway in the Lake District, and he wrote a sonnet about it in protest. And I'd like to read this to you now.
Please do.
So, on the projected Kendal and Windermere Railway by Sir William Wordsworth. Is there no nook of English ground secure from rash assault? Schemes of retirement sown in youth, and mid the busy world kept pure, as when their earliest flowers of hope were blown, must perish. How can this blight endure? And must he too the ruthless change bemoan, who scorns a false utilitarian lure, mid his paternal fields at random thrown? Baffle the threat, bright seen from Orist head, given to the pausing traveller's rapturous glance. Plead for thy peace, thou beautiful romance of nature. And if human hearts be dead, speak, passing winds, ye torrents, with your strong and constant voice, protest against the wrong.
Ooh, so Wordsworth is pretty much calling for adverse weather conditions here.
I think he would love, exactly, he'd love the wind to raise up, the rain to go backwards, and for the Kendal and Windermere Railway to be, to actually not take place at all. I think he would have liked that very much. He even wrote to local MPs, to the future Prime Minister of Britain, in fact, to Gladstone, to try to prevent it. But unluckily for him, but potentially luckily for the area, it did happen. So there we are. We're off again. I think they might have cleared the leaves.
Mm, that's good.
Very good. So we're accelerating to the dizzying speed of about 20 to 30 miles an hour. Izzy, as the centrifugal force pushes me back in my seat, I think it might be time for a few quotes. I've actually prepared a little quiz for you as well.
Ooh, again.
Yeah, I couldn't possibly let you be the only person to do a quiz, and we do have to have some competitive zeal in our program. So here we are. I've got, like last time, three quotes, literary quotes about travel. You have to guess who said them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a clue at the very beginning, just to give you a hand. There are two Americans and one Brit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's the only clue I'm going to get from. First one. People don't take trips. Trips take people. Who said that?
Someone who's either American or British.
Good start.
Give me another clue.
I thought I said I was only going to give you one clue. Okay, I'll give you one more clue. I'll tell you the title of the book. Mm. Travels with Charlie in Search of America. That's a fairly large clue.
So probably American.
Yeah, you're on the right lines.
Is Charlie the Black Poodle? Was that... I think I got that book for someone. Mm-hmm. Present once.
Okay.
And that
might be from...
John Steinbeck?
Very good. Woo. Very good. You're off to a flyer.
Hooray.
You're off to a flyer. Very good.
Nice. Okay. Second one.
The only way is up. Okay. I had learnt the satisfaction which comes from hardship and the pleasure which derives from abstinence, the contentment of a full belly, the richness of meat, the taste of clean water, the ecstasy of surrender when the craving of sleep becomes a torment, the warmth of a fire in the chill of dawn. Very evocative text.
Yeah, that sounds very British, I think.
Might just be the way I'm reading it. I could have done it in an American accent.
But
I'll be very impressed if you get this.
Yeah, it sounds very adventurous,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay, this is a British travel writer, very well known for, well, I say very well known, relatively well known for having explored the Empty Quarter in Oman. Wilfred Thesiger.
Hmm.
I'd have been very impressed if you'd got that.
I don't think I've ever heard.
No, okay. But I'm glad to have educated you in some small way.
Yeah.
Okay, last but not least. Now, you should get this one. It's not Sir Winston Churchill, so pleased to hear I won't have to do an accent.
Well, it's going to be the American, though, right?
Yeah, but I'm not going to do an American. That'd be terrible. Here we go. I tramp the perpetual journey. My signs are a rainproof coat, good shoes, and a staff cut from the woods. No friend of mine takes his ease in my chair. I have no chair, no philosophy. I lead no man to a dinner table, library, exchange. But each man and each woman of you I lead upon a knoll. My left hand hooking you round the waist. My right hand pointing to landscapes of continents and the public road. Not I, nor anyone else can travel that road for you. You must travel it for yourself.
Too much wind.
So, who said that?
That must be Walt Whitman.
Oh, very good.
Sounds
very good.
Whitman.
You're improving also, your ratio. You're up to 66.6%.
Hooray.
Very.
Also, did you just sneak in another poem and just pretend that it was a quote?
It is a poem. I'll tell you, it's actually from The Song of Myself by Walt Whitman. It's an excerpt.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have read the whole thing, but sadly we do not have time.
Ooh.
Ooh. Yeah.
Food.
It looks very good, doesn't it?
Yeah. What
very old-style refreshment trolley. We seem to have wandered back into the Victorian era. What have they got on it, Izzy?
They've got jellied eels and jugged hare.
Jugged hare. Fantastic.
And brown Windsor soup?
Let me just have a look at the menu in front of me. Brown Windsor soup. Ah, yes, here we are. Beef, gravy, malt vinegar, pepper, dark dried fruits like dates and figs, and an optional dash of Madeira. I recommend that for you, although perhaps without the Madeira, otherwise you'll miss the next episode.
Oh, come on.
I'm going to have the jugged hare.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I haven't eaten anything for days, so I think that looks very good.
Right.
Tasty. So.
Where are we going, actually?
I think we might be heading north.
Yeah.
It seems to be getting sort of hillier,
don't you think? Yeah. Oh, is that the sea that we can see through?
Not sure. Did you just get a glimpse of something?
Yeah, it looks like there's a little strip of blue behind those trees. Actually, Strip of Blue is the name of a poem.
Okay.
By an American writer called Lucy Larcom.
Are you trying to sneak American authors in again?
I am.
Ah. Sneaky.
So good. Lucy Larcom, very interesting character. I think her life would make a really good film. So she was born in 1824, the second youngest of 10 children. And her father died when she was very young, so...
He was probably quite old when she was born, if he had 10 kids.
Probably. To sort of, provide for the family, she had to start working at the age of 11.
But not as a poet.
Not as a poet. She published her first manuscript of poems at the age of 7.
She published?
Well, only to herself and
okay.
in secret.
Okay.
But she wrote them all down.
Still.
But anyway, she started working at a cotton mill at the age of 11, doing little tasks around the mill.
Mm-hmm.
But then eventually she worked there as a bookkeeper.
Wow.
An intellectual task.
Mm.
And so that gave her more free time, more leisure time to read English and German literature, learn about grammar. and write stories and poems for a literary magazine called Lowell Offering,
okay,
which published the poetry and stories written by the Lowell Mill Girls, or the female workers.
Reminds me of the poet we had last time.
Yeah, Amy Lowell.
Amy Lowell.
Same
yeah.
name. Yeah.
There we
well,
are. Synchronicity.
It's crazy. And yeah, so that was sort of her way into an educated life, and then she worked as a teacher and a writer and an editor.
Wow.
And
so she really worked her way up and ended up becoming that the very thing that she wanted to be when she was 7 years old. That's
exactly.
amazing.
Exactly, it's fantastic. And from her office at the Lowell Mill, she could see a river.
Ah,
a strip of blue.
Traveling
into freedom.
Oh, let's hear it then.
And that's the poem, A Strip of Blue by Lucy Larcom. I do not own an inch of land, but all I see is mine. The orchard and the mowing fields, the lawns and gardens fine. The winds my tax collectors are. They bring me tithes divine, wild scents and subtle essences, a tribute rare and free. And more magnificent than all, my window keeps for me a glimpse of blue immensity, a little strip of sea. Richer am I than he who owns great fleets and argosies. I have a share in every ship won by the inland breeze. To loiter on yon airy road above the apple trees, I fright them with my untold dreams. Each bears my own picked crew, and nobler cargoes wait for them than ever India knew. My ships that sail into the east across that outlet blue. Sometimes they seem like living shapes, the people of the sky, guests in white raiment coming down from heaven, which is close by. I call them by familiar names, as one by one draws nigh. So white, so light, so spirit-like, from violet mists they bloom. The aching wastes of the unknown are half reclaimed from gloom, since on life's hospitable sea, all souls find sailing room.
Lovely. What a lovely poem. And I'm glad I can still think of the strip of blue, because actually I can't see it anymore. We've lost sight of the coast. I still think we're heading north. It seems to be getting colder, but I'm not quite sure.
I think we need to get our tickets out, I think.
Can you see someone coming?
Yeah, there's someone coming up down.
All right. Yeah, okay. I have no idea where we're going. Let's get tickets out, yeah.
Tickets and passes, please. Can I see all tickets and passes?
Yeah, I think that's... Yeah, there you go.
There you go, there's mine as well.
Oh, they're right. Morning.
Morning.
Mm. Oh, you need to get off at the next stop, though, right?
Really?
All right, okay. Oh, well, it's good to know. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
He looks a bit familiar, doesn't he?
Isn't that...
Sorry, are you Rowan McCabe, the door-to-door poet?
Is it Rowan?
I am.
Oh, wow. Such an honour to meet you. Would you like to... take a seat and
have you got time? You come and sit with us. We're just enjoying a little bit of jelly deals and jugged hare. We're just and a Windsor soup as well. You come and sit with us and let's ask you a few questions.
Oh, go on then. Yeah, it's pretty quiet on the train, to be honest.
Very good. Well, pull up a pew. Rowan, fantastic. So because we weren't sure you were on the train because we hadn't seen you. That explains why we hadn't seen you. You're the ticket collector of all things. Tell us, you are a door-to-door poet. That's the first thing our listeners should know. This is a kind of new job. This is not available at the job centre. A door-to-door poet, first of all, what is a door-to-door poet? And what is a typical day in the life of a door-to-door poet?
Well, a door-to-door poet is a thing that I invented about 5 years ago. And it involves knocking on strangers' doors and writing bespoke poems for them on any subject that they're choosing. So I pick a random street, and I don't know anyone on that street. I knock on a door, I count to about 45 in my head, and if nobody answers, then I move on. But every now and again, someone answers, and when they do, I ask them if they can spare about a minute and 10 seconds and tell them I'm doing an art project. And if they say yes, I do a poem for them. And that poem basically describes what I'm there for and asks them to have a chat with it about something that's important to them. And after that, hopefully they're interested and we have a conversation. It can be about absolutely anything they like. It could be something
you know, huge and really serious, or it could be something small and really silly. But whatever it is, we have a conversation and then I go away. I try and find a handful of people in every place I go to, and then I go home. I spend a couple of weeks writing the poems, and a few weeks later I come back and deliver them for each person. So I give them a written copy and I perform it on the doorstep for them as well.
Fantastic. So what have the reactions been like?
Varied. So, initially I wasn't sure if it was actually even going to work. A lot of people also told us that it wasn't going to work. So I tried it in Newcastle upon Tyne, where I live. Tried it in a little suburb called Heaton. Yeah, it went quite well. The question sort of became, well, you know, Heaton's quite a sort of, quite a student-y area. There's quite a lot of young professionals and people, I think, understandably said, well, yeah, you know, it would work in a place like that, but I'd love to see you try it on a council estate. And this kind of bothered us because I grew up on a council estate. Well, it was a home housing estate, which is like a private version. It's essentially the same thing. It's with thinner walls and more damp. And I decided I was going to try it in a council estate near where I live, called the Bike on Wall. It was even better than I could have hoped for. Like, I was only looking for 5 people, and I found 7 people. I just couldn't stop finding them. Like, I would meet someone, and then they'd say, oh, well, you have to come and meet my sister. Like, I met a guy called Carl, and he said, you have to come and see my sister, Gemma. And so then we went to her house. The other thing that was interesting was the responses were so varied and, you know, seemed to really be questioning your preconceptions about what someone on an estate like that might want to talk about. You know, like, we talked about everything from I met a judo expert, I met someone who wanted to talk about the problems with organized religion, somebody who was worried about the pressure on young girls growing up in a male-dominated society. It was really exciting and made us think, maybe this isn't just about writing poems for people, but it's also about questioning stereotypes about different groups of people and questioning where those ideas come from.
Have you made any lasting friendships out of this?
Yeah, I'm still in touch with a few people in the project, yeah. You occupy a weird space as a door poet, I think. It's akin to, like, the postman or something like that. Like, if I saw the postman in the street, I would give him a wave and a nod, but I wouldn't necessarily
invite him in for tea and cakes.
Send him a letter. understandably, I think some of the conversation sort of petered up, but there's a few, definitely, especially because I'm writing a show about what happened to us when I went around England, but I'm sure we'll come back to that later. But I was messaging a few people just to explain I might be in their neck of the woods and things like that.
What's the sort of the most outlandish or surprising thing that's happened to you on your travels as a door-to-door poet? You must have quite a few anecdotes.
I think actually going to Bike was one of those where, when I first met Carl, I knocked on his door and he had like a peak baseball cap on and a Newcastle United shirt. And I said, hi there, my name's Rowan and I'm doing an art project. Have you got a minute and 10 seconds? And he sort of nodded and I did my introductory poem for him that kind of explains why I'm there. And he just stared at us like completely deadpan. I had no idea throughout the course of this poem what he was making this at all. It was just impossible to judge. And I got to the end and I said, oh, well, cheers for listening. What's your name? And he said, Carl. And I said, okay, great. Well, tell us what's important to you, Carl. And he said, getting wrecked. And it felt like this was felt like it was a sort of testing the boundaries thing, you know, like he was trying to see, you know, exactly what I would do. And I said, well, you know, that's fine. I could write you a poem about getting wrecked, Carl. I mean, whatever's important to you, really. And he paused for a minute and something in his face seemed to change. And he said, well, you write as one about how much I love my girlfriend.
So he went from 0 to 100 in the space of about 5 seconds.
Yeah, and it was, I think just... That's happened a few times, I think, when people just seem to be, you know, I think we're all like that, really. Like, someone knocks on the door and you wonder what the actual motive is. They're probably going to try and sell you something, or, you know, there's something in it for them, and usually it's financial. And I think that happened quite a few times where people would just push the boundaries almost as a way of being like, well, this is going to undo whatever secret plan you have running under this, you know? I want to get to the bottom of what this is actually about. And then they realize that actually, no, I'm just an odd man who genuinely does want to just talk to them about anything they want to talk about.
So Rowan, you've been working on this project for 5 years now. You said you started in 2015?
Yep.
So it's quite a long time. Have things changed? Like you mentioned how, you know, you realized certain stereotypes might not be true. Or so have any other things changed in the way you react to people or people react to you? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the project kind of evolved as it was going along. I think it's changed me a lot as a person. And like experiences like that in Biker really changed the way I felt about my neighborhood. But then taking it national was like this next step where once I'd done stuff like go to Biker, I mean, for a while I was kind of quite happy with that. I felt like, you know, just to contextualize this for listeners, you know, it is an area where you kind of mention the Biker wall in the city I live in, and most people treat it with a degree of fear and worry. And then once it went quite well there, it was like, well, where else would it not work? But I wrote a show about the beginnings of the project, about going around the Northeast and places in the peninsula and stuff. And I was doing it at the Edinburgh Fringe, and a lady came up to us afterwards and said, this is such a fun idea, but it would only ever work in the Northeast. And I asked why, and she said, well, because Geordies are exceptionally kind. You know, there's no way you could do this in London.
Yeah.
And so then, again, it was like this process of like, well, as soon as someone told us I couldn't do it, then, well, then I
the gauntlet was laid down.
It was like, you know, people were saying, you know, you would never work someone like Moss Side in Manchester, which is another estate, which I think would be fair to say has a bit of a bad reputation. And yeah, and so I guess the project changed as it went on. And also, for me, it was about testing whether these pre-convictions were really true. And I guess generally, like spoiler alert, but I found that they generally weren't. You know, the people I met in these places, like in London and in Moss Side, they were all varied and unique, and it was very difficult to generalize about these groups. But I was very aware as I started to take it out of my home turf that I kind of held preconceptions, especially about Southerners.
Yeah,
you know,
of course,
I don't want any, but it's just been ingrained into us this feeling of like, you know, people in London are antisocial and standoffish and grumpy. And so, yeah, it was a learning curve for me to push my own preconceptions as well.
Just so that our listeners get an idea of how far you've gone with this, you've done pretty much the length and breadth of the UK. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't take it to Scotland, which was a shame. It was more of so it was just England that I was able to do, and that was down to the funding from Arts Council England, really. There was an option of trying to find a way of getting together some funding to do it in Scotland as well, but it sort of felt at the time as well that maybe this in itself could be interesting, you know, in a world where everything's become a very fragmented.
You've invented a new word. That's actually your job as a poet. So congratulations, we have a first on this show.
Yeah, in the fragmented, frazzle dazzly world that we live in, you know, where nationalism is on the rise and people are very strongly arguing for. Well, you know, there's a vote for Scottish independence.
Absolutely.
And I thought, well, in a world where we're really starting to strongly put our feet down and say, you know, England is different to Scotland, and you know, the UK is different to Europe, let's find out how different it really is, you know. Let's just focus on England and see what happens when you just stay somewhere like
Rowan,
that.
I mean, when Corona is finished, when the COVID crisis has finally ended, if that ever does come to pass, you should make an argument to the Arts Council that you could take this around the world. Door-to-door poetry international. How about it?
I have thought of that, actually. I think one day, yeah, I think I'd really like to write a book about what happened, and then one day in the distant future. The kind of idea I've had is that, because I want to kind of keep it a bit different every time as well. So I was thinking about a school of door-to-door poetry where in each country I train a crack team of brand new
door-to-door. A SWAT team of poets.
Which is something I did in The Hague once with a group of primary school children. I was asked to go to the British school in the Netherlands and work with some, I think they were about 6 or 7 years old. And we got a class of 30 kids and we did a workshop on, I guess, essentially how to be a journalist, like the basics of how to ask questions so that people keep talking, and you know, how to explore a subject when someone's in control of the conversation, and yeah, it was really cute. Like, then they went off to a different class where they didn't know anyone and they had to go up to them and pitch the idea and say, excuse me, I'm doing an art project and would you like to come and have a quick conversation with us, and the other children said yes, and then it was great. So yeah, that's one of the reasons I want to keep doing that. I mean, I hope that doesn't sound condescending. I would intend on working with adults in this version we're talking about, and I wouldn't treat them like small children, but I just I like the idea of passing it on.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
But at the very heart of it, it is just a project that wants to get people talking and break down some of the boundaries that we'll put up around each other. And you know, people have said to us before, well, why don't you copyright the idea? You don't want anyone else taking it. And I feel the exact opposite. It's like, if you want to go and do it, like, it's great, you know, like, keep yourself safe, you know. I've left a few tips on my website. And like, you know, it's like, at the heart of it, if you go and you write someone a nice poem and make a new friend, that's absolutely great. I'm not going to try and stop people doing that.
So how about we hear some of your poems?
We've heard, obviously, we've already heard your door-to-door poet poem. But yeah, what else would you like to read for us?
Great. Well, I put us in mind to want to do this one today with Biden's inauguration and everything that's going on in America at the minute. And I wrote this poem the day Trump became the president. Yeah, it was because I was in a place called Bensham in Gateshead, which is very near Newcastle. It was near the beginnings of the project. And I met a woman called Michelle, asked her what was important. And she said, well, there's a pub across the road called The Crown. And I'd never been to The Crown. So I thought, well, tomorrow, at the first opportunity, I will go down to The Crown for research, obviously, you know, not just to have a pint in the middle of the afternoon, because that would be incredibly unconventional. It was entirely research-based. Yeah, and literally just picked the next day, because that was the soonest time I could do it and get on with it. And it so happened that next morning was the morning that Donald Trump was announced as the next president of America. And so I went into The Crown and just wrote a poem about what happened when I went in, and a man I met called the captain, and this is it, called Dominoes.
The afternoon that Donald Trump has won, and there's a deadly quiet in the Crown. You only hear the fridges humming softly, the barmaid counting out loose scraps of change. There's three old men sat drinking by the bar. One of them's got a weathered captain's hat. No one speaks. There's not much he can say. Another taps his fingers on the woods. Eventually the barmaid speaks her mind. It still feels like it's all a stupid joke. It's not a funny one, the tapper adds. Oh, let's not talk about it, she replies. Politics in pubs just causes rows. A silence falls again as thick as fog. Of course, back in the day, the captain says, his gentle voice now filling up the space, pub arguments were caused by dominoes. By dominoes. By dominoes, he says. He talks about his journeys on the ocean, of clear blue skies and drinking lots of cans. He travels with a man they call the skipper, a friend you can depend on with your life. I dream I'm on a sailboat with a captain, drifting on a calm and distant sea, and a simple game of dominoes is all there is to scare or anger me.
Okay, thank you, Rowan. What a super poem, super poem. So, yeah, what... We've talked a lot about this, a long-term project in terms of travelling the UK and potentially, we hope, for you travelling the world. But what about any future plans? Tell us a little bit about what you've got lined up during COVID, after COVID. What's happening?
Well, at the minute, I'm doing a project for the National Trust. I am poet in residence at Wordsworth House in Cockermouth in the Lake District. The idea was to spend a lot of time in that house through the course of 2020 and early 2021, but for obvious reasons that hasn't happened. But it's been mostly done from home. So one project we came up with together was post-to-post poetry, which I feel, after the conversation we've had, should be fairly self-explanatory. So I've been sending off letters to people in Wordsworth's hometown and just asking them to write back and tell us what's important.
You do realise that as a ticket collector, you are going directly against Wordsworth because he hated all development and he hated the train.
He did, didn't he? Yeah. I think towards the end of his life, he got his head around the idea of a train station being in the Lake District, but he was really annoyed about it.
The Kendal Windermere train station, train line, he hated it, didn't he?
Yeah, so there's that. I've been writing a show about the trip around England as a door-to-door poet. I don't know when that's gonna. There was a date. Still is technically a date lined up in March for the opening night of that in Ark Stockton. It's probably better to just stay tuned at this stage. I think for dates and things like that, just it'll be up on the door-to-door poetry social media and stuff like that. But the plan is to do a tour as soon as I can get into a venue and do that. So the script is pretty much written.
Super.
We just do a week left of rehearsals with the director, and then get it up on its feet. So I'm looking forward to that when it does come off.
Fantastic. You probably have to get back to work, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can see the boss coming down the carriage.
The fat controller is coming. Thank you very much, Rowan. Rowan is now standing up. He's putting back on his ticket collecting hat. Rowan, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And I'm assuming that means we can travel free for the next leg of the journey, I'm assuming, because we know you.
No, I'm sorry. No. I mean, it's been nice chatting to you, but you can't go all the way to the end of the line. No, not with that ticket.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that's a shame. But
thanks anyway. And thanks for chatting with us.
Okay.
Cheers, Rowan. So that was Rowan McCabe, the famous Rowan McCabe. Fantastic.
Yeah. He seems to be taking his job pretty seriously.
He certainly is. Yeah, I mean, it looks like we have to get off at the next stop.
Yeah.
Better get ourselves ready. I haven't even finished my jugged hair yet.
Actually, I'm kind of looking forward to stepping out and, you know, going for a walk. I feel
are you getting claustrophobic?
Yeah, I feel a bit confined in here. And
maybe you've had too much Windsor soup.
That might also be it. Yeah, and I feel like travelling, you know, is all about the freedom.
It's all about freedom, yeah.
Going out, and actually, another poem I found.
Oh, what a surprise.
What a surprise.
Yes. And who's this by? Please, please don't tell me it's another American author.
She is.
Oh, my word.
But her name is Olive Runner.
Olive Runner?
As in running.
Okay.
Which is a great name.
Very apt for someone who seeks freedom, I suppose. Yeah.
And interestingly enough, I couldn't find any information about her on the internet, which is rare in these days.
Very rare, yeah.
So if we have any literary scholars listening who'd like to investigate Olive Runner or have investigated Olive, please let us know. I'd be very interested in hearing more about her.
Let's start a Wikipedia page about Olive Runner.
Yeah.
Yes, why not?
And yeah, she wrote a poem aptly called Freedom and published it in 1918. Freedom by Olive Runner. Give me the long, straight road before me. A clear, cold day with nipping air. Tall, bare trees to run on beside me. A heart that is light and free from care. Then let me go. I care not whither my feet may lead, for my spirit shall be free as the brook that flows to the river. Free as the river that flows to the sea.
Beautiful. I have a feeling we are flowing to the sea. I think I can see your strip of blue again.
True, yeah.
Glimmering in the distance.
I think before we, you know, have to get off the train, I still need to do my pub quiz for you.
That's true. You've still got me as a captive prisoner, so now's your chance.
All right.
Now see if I can do better than 66.6%.
Yeah, well, three questions for you.
Only three? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a place name quiz, because Britain is famous for its ridiculous place names, like Llanfair and then
Gogogoch. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So I've got three pairs of places, and then in these pairs, one is a real place and one is a fictional place.
Mm-hmm.
And I need you to tell me which one's
which
real.
Which is real. Okay, okay.
All right. So, first one. On the one hand, we've got Compton Ponsford. And on the other, we've got Chipping Cleghorn.
That's easy, because I know Compton Ponsford. So Compton Ponsford is real, and Chipping Cleghorn, or whatever it's called, Foghorn Leghorn, is definitely not right.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Excellent.
Compton Ponsford, which sounds like a perfect name for a cat investigator.
That's very true. Compton Ponsford, that's true. Yes, the cat investigator. It should have been in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats, shouldn't it?
Yeah. And Chipping Cleghorn is actually where the some of a murder is announced is set. Miss Marple investigates.
Oh, it's a Miss Marple. Okay.
Yeah, in Chipping Cleghorn.
Chipping Cleghorn. I love it. It must have been in the Cotswolds, the fictional Cotswolds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Next one. We've got Nether Adelthorpe, and we've got Mudfort Sock.
Okay, I know the first one is false because I know that it comes from Loriot.
Correct.
So the second one must be correct.
Yes, that's correct. Nether Adelthorpe, Loriot sketch.
That's right, Middle German, Frithum, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, German comedian who wrote a sketch about all these funny places.
That's right, very funny sketch.
Yeah, Mudfort Sock. I thought
Mudfort Sock.
Mudfort Sock. I thought
Mudfort
it was
Sock.
That band, you know, Mudfort and Socks.
Do you mean Mumford and Sons?
Yeah.
Mudfort and Socks. Right. Although it has a certain ring to it, I'll give you that. Good. So we're level.
All right.
We're both on 66 points. So now you're going to have to give me a real, really difficult one.
Right. So now we've got Lower Tadfield and Upton Snodsbury.
Upton Snodsbury. Lower Tadfield. The second one is so outrageous, it has to be correct. I'm going to go for that.
Ah, it is correct.
Yes.
Upton Snodsbury, near North Piddle in Worcestershire.
North Piddle. Wonderful. Wonderful.
And Lower Tadfield is a lovely place, fictional place in Oxfordshire, where the Antichrist lives.
Who lives there?
The Antichrist.
The Antichrist? Why
yeah.
does he live in Lower Tadfield?
Well,
and not in Upper Snodsbury?
Lots of mistakes. It's in Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman's Good Omens.
I see. You've done a lot of research on this. Very
yeah.
good. I'm enjoying these quizzes. But I'm afraid, I'm still winning.
You are. Got all of them right.
I'm going to have to up your game for next
Upton
time.
Upton Snodsbury. I want to live in Upton Snodsbury.
So do I. I definitely don't want to live next to the Antichrist, that's for sure. But speaking of funny names
yes.
and all of these rather odd place names, I have a poem for you written by Percy Shelley. 1792 to 1822, about a statue in the desert. And the name of the poem is Ozymandias. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. So, yes, a caveat to all those people who think they have achieved endless power and riches, but time catches up with all of us.
So who was Ozymandias?
Ozymandias is a Greek name for the Egyptian emperor Ramesses II. And in 1818, if my research is correct, the British Museum actually found, let me just look at my notes here, they found, or rather they brought back
Rameses II, or rather part of a statue, a fragment of the statue, brought to the British Museum. And Shelley wanted to write a poem about it, and he had a sort of a competition to write a sonnet about it with a compatriot of his, a friend of his, Horace Smith. So they both wrote a sonnet about Ozymandias, the same title. And it's about the decline of greatness and the decline of these great rulers.
Looking out of the window, this doesn't look like the desert, but it looks a bit deserted out there.
Certainly it's deserted. I mean, I can see hills, moorland. Oh, a glimpse of the coast.
There you go.
So we might still be heading to the coast. We are also slowing down, so the last stop might be coming. We should get ourselves ready.
Yeah. I feel need to digest my brown Windsor soup. How are you
Windsor
with your
soup? My jugged hair. Well, first of all, I haven't finished it, so I better get eating. And secondly, I definitely haven't digested it. I should have become a vegetarian, I think. Right. But before we arrive, we should definitely get in at least one more poem, I think. I definitely wanted to read. We started with Robert Louis Stevenson, and I think it would only be fitting to finish also with Robert Louis Stevenson, at least from our side. And I found a poem called Travel. I should like to rise and go where the golden apples grow, where below another sky Parrot Islands anchored lie, and watched by cockatoos and goats, lonely Crusoes building boats, where in sunshine reaching out, eastern cities miles about are with mosque and minaret among the sandy gardens set, and the rich goods from near and far hang for sale in the bazaar, where the great wall round China goes, and on one side the desert blows, and with the voice and bell and drum cities on the other hum, where the forests hot as fire, wide as England, tall as a spire, full of apes and cocoa nuts, and the negro hunters' huts, where the knotty crocodile lies and blinks in the Nile, and the red flamingo flies hunting fish before his eyes, where in jungles near and far man-devouring tigers are, lying close and giving ear lest the hunt be drawing near, or a comer-by be seen swinging in the palanquin, where among the desert sands some deserted city stands, all its children, sweep and prince, grown to manhood ages since, not a foot in street or house, not a stir of child or mouse. And when kindly falls the night, in all the town no spark of light, there I'll come when I'm a man, with a camel caravan, light a fire in the gloom of some dusty dining room, see the pictures on the walls, heroes, fights and festivals, and in a corner find the toys of the old Egyptian boys. It's very evocative, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You can tell that Robert Louis Stevenson really liked travelling.
He loved travelling. He was a real traveller, actually, Stevenson. Do you know anything about his life?
I know that he's Scottish.
He's Scottish. He actually comes from a family of engineers who built lighthouses, but he didn't want to be a lighthouse builder, so he actually ended up training for the bar. He became a lawyer, but his literary paths led him away from that. And he wrote a lot about travel, an inland voyage in 1878 and 1879, travels with a donkey in the Cevennes, for example. He married, he went to America, he was in San Francisco for a while, in Monterey. He came back to live with his wife in Dorset, which is where he wrote, which books is he?
Treasure Island. Jekyll and Hyde,
The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
And?
I don't know.
Kidnapped. Another very famous, very famous Robert Louis Stevenson. Maybe we should do a quiz about it next week. Mm. Yeah, but I guess the most adventurous thing he did, he sort of set sail from San Francisco in 1888 and travelled to Tahiti, the Gilbert Islands, and Samoa. In Samoa, 1890, that's where he actually built a house and lived until the end of his life. in 1894, where he died. So he was only 44 when he died. Ooh. Plagued by ill health most of his life, but a real traveller through and through. Absolutely.
Oh, there's the station.
Oh, are we here?
Yeah. And I think I can vaguely hear the sea.
Yes, you are right. We have arrived at the coast. I can smell fish and chips and oysters.
I think I'll go for the fish and chips.
So we're on a train and we appear to be in the Lake District. Could that be Morecambe Bay? Or somewhere similar. I think Wordsworth would be turning in his grave. Unfortunately, rather like my stomach.
Should we step off the train?
Let's get off the train. Yeah, don't forget your bag, is he?
Yeah, I'll grab it. Do you know Rowan's final poem in the door-to-door poetry collection is actually about a seaside town, Jaywick, which is not unlike Morecambe. Doesn't have the best reputation. It's one of the most deprived areas in the UK, as is the West End of Morecambe. And ooh, look, Alano, I think if you hold this seashell to your ear, you might hear the poem.
Don't be ridiculous.
Just, you know, try it.
To Jaywick. Yes, Jaywick, I'll confess my reservations before I came. Your headlines I had read. I got the bus, explained my destination, the driver fixed us with a look of dread. But on that morning, walking on your beach, the sky was clear, the sun bobbed on the waves, the soft and golden sand was at my feet. Dog walkers smiled and went about their day, and honestly, it took us by surprise. Your natural beauty shook away my blues. I couldn't help but pause and wonder why this scene had never featured on the news. For certain, as each summer fades to brown, the tabloids yearly come here for a snap of what they've dubbed a run-down, worthless town, though who's in charge of it, they never ask. They hunt for weeds and windows that need fixed. They hover around like poachers in the road, but do they stay for views as grand as this before they pen their articles of woe? Because I know you've got your problems, Jaywick, but people here are welcoming and kind, and Aussies does the perfect fish and chips next to a pub that's called Never Say Die. But that won't make the front page, nor the sea, as it glitters here above your coastal shelf. When papers only deal in misery, I'm pleased I found the truth out for myself.
Good poem, eh?
It's a lovely poem. Very apt and, very, very similar to where we are now, actually. Yeah, Morecambe Bay.
Yeah, I think it's a good sort of connection to our next episode. And we're hoping to see you there, next episode, The Sea.
What a fantastic pun,
right?
Izzy. Very, very
I'm
nice pun.
Learning from the best.
By the way, thank you very much from the king of alliteration himself. By the way, to all of our listeners, if you would like to make any recommendations for our next episode, The Sea, if there's any poems you'd like to hear, or your favourite poem, which has anything to do with the sea or ships or anything maritime whatsoever, don't hesitate to send us your recommendation. Either Twitter, so @the_poetry_pod, or by email, and this is going to be in German now, ensemble@gesprochenes-wort.de. So don't hesitate to send us your recommendations. Yeah. We'd love to hear them.
If your German isn't that good, we'll also put the email and the Twitter in the description so you can find our contacts there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Speaking of titles, Izzy, how about for next time?
Mm-hmm.
How about Sea in Sentences?
Orlando.
Sea in Surrealism.
We talked about this.
You can't be against this. Sea and Certitude.
Well, Certitude begins with a C. You know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Okay, all right. So that's no good. But what about Sea and Sausage?